and welcome to the all-new Photography and Video Show podcast. I'm David McClelland, and on the first Thursday of every month, we'll be here to fill your kit bag with not only the latest news from the world of photography, filmmaking and video, but with chats with professionals right at the top of their game, plus some competitions and, well, who knows what else, because this is the first episode and frankly we're just going to see where it takes us. What we do know is that later on in today's show we'll be hearing from a renowned portrait photographer who was an integral part of one of this year's most watched television events worldwide. The man behind the official coronation images of King Charles III and the royal family, Hugo Bernand.
It made me fall back in love with the art of medium format portraiture. I don't know what it is about that camera. I love the results it gives. I love the feel. And I love all the technical stuff, which is way above my sort of brain capacity. But I was incredibly lucky to have been introduced to that camera.
That's all coming up later on. But first, joining me this month to muse over the news is editor of Digital Camera World, James Arteas. Hello, James.
Hello, David. And it's really, really exciting, first of all, to be here, but also to bring to the wider listenership some of the conversations that you and I have sort of shared in the past. I always find that the chats we have off air or sort of, you know, over a coffee, those are some of the most interesting sort of little insights and tidbits about the industry and about things we've seen, or like, oh, do you know this? This is cool. Or, ah, I've just played with this toy. And it's a real privilege to get to share that with more of the folks in the industry and, you know, tell people about things they might not have known about, or just share some silly stories that you and I have.
Absolutely. So how about we dive in with this month's news?
Nothing would please me more. I'm always up for a bit of news, especially since there's so much going on right now. It's very newsworthy.
Let's kick off with Nikon, with our friends at Nikon, and they've taken the wraps off the Z8, or I'm sure it's been called the Z8 in places. It looks like a right beast of a camera, James, and I think you had some hands-on time with the Z8 only this week, and you were getting up close and personal to some actual beasts, weren't you?
Absolutely correct. Yes, I've had a fair bit of time playing with the new Z8, or as you say, the Nikon Z8, as it is in some territories. And I, you know, because one of the things about the flagship cameras, the pro level cameras, is their tracking, the autofocus, the sort of very, very sticky, robust tracking and detection systems. So I thought, short of going on a quick safari, visit one of the wonderful local zoos down near where I live, which is lovely Longleat, and just see how the camera fared when pointing it at everything from turtles to big cats to everything in between, red pandas when I could find them. But being able to sort of point it at zebras and saying, what does it make of that? Does it focus on the stripe or the eyeball? Trying to find animals behind foliage. Does it focus on the leaves, which is often the case? Does it find the beastie hiding sort of between the leaves? And it has to be said, the Z8 is truly, truly formidable. This is a baby Z9. That is, in fact, what Nikon, that's how they described it to me when they were telling me about it, which is very interesting because on the one hand, you say, well, why didn't you release a product? You know, given that it's got a different name, ostensibly is a different product, but why have you released a product that's basically your existing flagship camera, but without the vertical grip, so without the pro DSLR style grip that people know about? It's for that very reason. We had the opportunity to build any camera we wanted to with a Z8, but we're very, very aware that there are some people, this sort of speaks to your earlier point, David, there are some people in the industry who will only buy a quote-unquote pro camera with a big body and, you know, that looks the part. And there are some people who will only buy a smaller body without the big grip. They might both want the exact same specs, which is what Nikon's reckoning is. The big difference is some people need the big grip and some people definitely do not want it. So they've essentially released the same camera with a different shape of body, which is, I don't know if it's unprecedented. It's certainly very unusual. But the long and short of it is the Z8 is a Z9 that costs about a grand less, has the exact same level of performance. Because it's got the most recent firmware, it's actually a little bit more advanced at this moment in time. Honestly, so far, it's a three-horse race. You have the Sony A1, which is Sony's flagship 50-megapixel beast, the Z8, which is 45-megapixel flagship beast, and you've got Canon's R3, which is their de facto flagship, because the real flagship will be the Canon EOS R1. But because that is not here yet, and That is rumored. Well, it's confirmed to be in development. It would not be silly for us to assume that an R1 might appear in time for the Olympics next year. But yes, as things stand right now, it's the R3. Anyway, back to the Z8, which is what I started talking about. It is a very, very, very nice camera at a very, very nice price point. And I think it's going to sell better than proverbial hotcakes.
So, well, we'll come back to hotcakes, I think, later on. But in terms of positioning here, assuming that people are going to be going from, you know, Nikon shooters are going to be going from a DSLR over to the mirrorless system, if that's the journey that Nikon envisages for them, which is the equivalent? You know, I've shot with D800, D850 before. Would I be right in thinking that the Z8 is the mirrorless equivalent, the next step on the road for those photographers?
Very, very much, yes. And that was again, part of Nikon's sort of double-barreled and perhaps slightly jarring messaging, was sort of they were telling us, you know, This is the baby Z9, and also in the same breath saying this is the literal quote, this is the true successor to the D850.
Right.
So
okay,
it's fulfilling two roles there. Not that you can't do two things at once, but it's just sort of they seem to be separate messages. Of course, flagships tend to be things like the D5 and D6, but a lot of professionals use the D850 because again, that was the beast of the DSLR era, and I think most people, regardless of what system they used, would probably concede that the D850 was the best DSLR ever made. Certainly the best, most well-rounded, the most capable, the one you would take on any job to shoot any sort of end product. You know, the thing with the Z9 was when that was released, couldn't get them. They were absolutely, you know, it was like finding hand sanitizer during the pandemic. You just could not get them for love nor money. Whereas Nikon has sort of said, okay, we realize now that people want this camera in fairly large volumes. So they've taken a bit of a punt and put a lot of resource into making sure that there are plenty of Z8s available. Hopefully this one should not be the unicorn that the Z9 was.
Final thought on this, as I was reading your piece on this, you mentioned some of the firmware power-ups on there, and in terms of the image tracking, the autofocus tracking, and the fact that above the Z9, this has got plane tracking. I was taken back 18 months ago to Storm Eunice, February 2022, and Big Jet TV. Do you remember Big Jet TV that day
when
most of the country was tuned in? Jerry Dyer, his name, and he was there on top of a pickup truck outside Heathrow Airport, getting so enthusiastic about these planes that were coming into Heathrow. Jerry's been able to leave his job and do Big Jet TV full time now, I read in a story on The Guardian.
Wow.
Maybe if he were to invest in a Nikon Z8 with its incredible video capabilities, by the sounds of it, then he'd be in a pretty good place to do Big Jet TV with even more accurate tracking of those planes as they fly through the sky.
Hats off to Big Jet TV. If you can turn that into your full-time occupation, you know, let's sponsor this boy and get him a Z8. Let's get him some kit to play with.
Sky's the limit, Jerry. Anyway, moving on to our next story. From one end of the market, perhaps to another, the Canon EOS R100. So continuing the mirrorless camera fest. Some reviewers on the R100 believe that Canon's new entry-level mirrorless camera may be out of touch with beginners. But James, you mentioned hotcakes before. I think you're going to come up with a hotcakes line again. You think the R100 will also sell like hotcakes as well. I think both views may have some merits here. But first of all, what is the R100?
Okay, so the Canon EOS R100, it is Canon's latest entry-level camera, but in mirrorless form. So obviously it already makes cameras like the 2000D and the 250D, but that's using DSLR technology. That's old school tech. They still produce those cameras at the moment, but I think it's fairly safe to say every manufacturer, with the exception of Pentax, is still sort of clinging onto the DSLR war wagon until the bitter end. There are many advantages of an older fashioned DSLR camera, but there are many more advantages of mirrorless technology. So the R100 effectively replaces cameras like the 250D and the 2000D as, again, the cheap and cheerful. I'm doing air quotes as I say that, which you know, most people won't be able to see, because cheap and cheerful in a mirrorless context is different to cheap and cheerful in a DSLR context. So you could get an entry-level, good DSLR, you know, $300 upwards will get you. It's not going to be the all singing, all dancing thing, right? But it's going to be a good camera that's going to take you good images, and it's great for photography students. It's great for soccer mums. It's great for, you know, people who just, that maybe they're elevating from their smartphone, they want something with a bit more image quality, they want to be able to change lenses or take advantage of depth of field and things. So if you just want your first ever camera, I was going to say Fisher Price, my first camera, but that's giving the wrong thing. This is not a Fisher Price camera. You know, if it is your first entry point into the world of interchangeable lens cameras, you want an entry level thing. A, because you need it to be simple enough to use, because giving someone a Z8 I review cameras for a living. You review tech and cameras for a living. Someone gives either of us a Z8. It takes us a little while, you know, to find the brightness setting in the menu, all of that sort of stuff. So for somebody who doesn't know what aperture is, there's no point giving them a big, crazy thing. They need an entry-level camera that is designed to be simple and is designed to support the user. And that's what the R100 does. It's not an underpowered camera. I think people make the mistake of thinking entry-level equals naff or not good in some way. It is lacking in some of the features that more advanced cameras have, certainly. But to suggest that it's not a good camera, I took it around for a walk around with me a couple of weeks ago, and you couldn't tell what camera these photographs were taken on. You know, I think we've long passed that point of pixel peeping and going, oh, well, that was a 10 megapixel camera. Your pictures are rubbish. It's a 24 megapixel sensor. It's the same one that's in a lot of other Canon cameras, such as the EOS M50 Mark II, which is one of the most popular sort of travel and vlogging cameras. It's speaking to what I was just saying about the trickle-down effect of technology. So it has dual pixel AF, which is Canon's hybrid phase detect and contrast detect system. So you're getting the same tech that's in Canon's flagship DSLRs, you know, the 1DX Mark III, the 5D Mark IV. You're getting the same autofocus tech in a camera that costs £600 with a lens. So in that regard, to suggest that this is in somehow a less than capable camera is very disingenuous. Does it have some drawbacks? Yes, potentially. It doesn't have a flippy screen. Most people don't mind about a flippy screen. The main thing for me is it doesn't have a touch screen.
Yes.
And that's the thing, because you're trying to convince folks this is a step up from your smartphone. This is the next logical step in your journey. But of course, anyone who takes photos on a smartphone is going to be stabbing the screen. And if you do that on the R100, it will not respond.
And it's that usability point in a way, because you want to lead people, particularly if it is the first, again, big air quotes on my side here, proper camera, interchangeable lens camera. You want it to be a journey that they're eased into, that they feel as though, yeah, okay, I can get this. And if people are used to touch screens, whether it's through their phones or through other cameras, if all of a sudden they don't have that anymore, it might almost feel like it's a step backwards, like going up to big boy cameras actually feels like it's a step backwards for them and hinders them on that journey. I think that's one of the concerns.
Agreed. And I can only imagine my response if I bought the new iPhone this year and it didn't have touch capability.
Just imagine.
there would be some backlash. There may be some Reddit threads on that subject. And that's very valid. I presented that to Canon and they said, what did you think? And I said, this is great. That's a real shame. I think that's a missed opportunity. We are talking about a camera that is intended to be as affordable as possible.
Yeah.
So that it is accessible to the entry-level user. Now, that is an unfortunate compromise. But if we're talking about why doesn't it have a flippy screen? Why doesn't it have a touch screen? Because at the end of the day, it's trying to be affordable. So that's a compromise. It might be a step too far for some people. You might get your head around it. I think we need to cut it a little bit of slack and remember that this is the equivalent of the 250D. And the reason I think it's going to sell like hotcakes is because the 250D did and the 2000D did. And if you talk to Canon, they will say those are two of our most important products because those are the ones everybody buys.
But I think how the world has changed from when maybe you and I were first getting on board with these cameras. We're no longer going from literally a Fisher-Price, my first camera, to something with interchangeable lenses and all the menu systems. My concern, back to my point earlier, is that people are going from really sophisticated camera systems on their phones with touch screens. And that's the big sticking point here for me. The articulated screen, take it or leave it, really, I think, at this level. But I think it's that touch screen which maybe the world has moved on a little bit, and that might, for some people, be a compromise too far.
And I think you're right. The world has moved on. It's a tricky thing for me to get over the touch screen. I think what's important for Canon at this point is it's all in the messaging. Less that this replaces your smartphone, and more that this does the things your smartphone cannot do.
Thank you, James. And we'll come back to the news in a few minutes' time. Now, a few days ago, I caught up with a portrait photographer who knew that his images from an hour-long shoot on a rainy Saturday in May would feature on the front pages of newspapers, glossy magazines, and websites around the world, not only for the following days, but for years to come. No pressure then. Hugo Benand, Royal Photographer, thank you so much for joining us. Not even 2 weeks have passed since the coronation of King Charles. My first question has to be, how are you feeling now?
Feeling pretty good, to be honest with you. I've got over the first excitement, and then there's a sort of dip in energy levels because it was months of preparation building up to the 1 hour of photography that we did. And I had my down day on Monday, which I thought was a good day just to do nothing, knowing that everyone else was going off to work and I just did nothing on Monday. And now I seem to be back on track.
I'm pleased to hear it. You are absolutely no stranger to working with the royal family. You've worked on a number of pieces, a number of shoots with them in the past, haven't you?
I have. I've probably worked with the pair of them for nearly 20 years. The first photograph I took of them together was as they walked down the aisle at their wedding. I then did some formal photographs back in Windsor Castle after that. I had photographed, as she was then, Camilla Parker Bowles, sort of three, four years before that, after I'd been introduced to her by her sister. And I did some portraits and some work for her osteoporosis charity. So we'd already built up some form of relationship through the camera prior to their wedding. And then since then, I've come back and done one or two jobs. William and Catherine's wedding, I suppose, was the biggest.
Let's go back to that Saturday of the coronation. The pressure is on. I've read in the past about your meticulous attention to detail in preparing for these shoots. So what can you share with us about your preparation, about the pressure that there was on the day of King Charles' coronation?
Well, it's a time I have to say it's incredibly important to have a very good team around you. And I have, in my opinion, undeniably the best team possible. And together we worked out where we were going to take each of the photographs we've been asked to take, how we were going to light them, and the order in which we were going to take them. And we wanted the journey for the King and the Queen and the other people who were being photographed to be fairly simple as we went through the schedule of photographs. So the planning is critical. We actually did three dress rehearsals this time with standards. When you actually come to do the shoot, you have 100% confidence in your equipment and in your team all around you. So it enables me as a photographer to engage with the people on the other side of the lens. Because, you know, it's that thing about portrait photography. I mean, you can get the lighting right, you can get the angles right, you can get the colors right, camera, everything. But if I can't feel some connection or emotion with the person that I'm photographing, you as the viewer of the photograph won't feel any of that emotion or connection either.
Were you able to do all three of those dress rehearsals on location?
We were in Buckingham Palace in the throne room for 3 days prior to the event. And we lit each photograph as an individual portrait and then tried to sort of stitch them all together. But there were different lights set up for each one. And the dress rehearsals, I have to say, they were great because they were a disaster.
A bad dress rehearsal means a good first night.
Well, exactly. Because the thing is, if everything goes right in the dress rehearsal, you're stuffed if anything goes wrong. So we had, I have to say, after the first dress rehearsal, people could have questioned why they'd employed us. But we all knew that actually everything that hadn't worked quite according to plan was part of why we'd done it. And I have to say, each dress rehearsal kicked up new issues that needed to be ironed out. And of the three dress rehearsals, we never had one that went absolutely smoothly. But that was fine. We were happy. We were confident. We were ready for anything that came our way. And the actual event went flawlessly.
with all of the planning, you're working out how many setups you can accomplish within the hour. It would be easy to go into that with a sense of hurry, with a sense of rush, with a sense of urgency that, if it were not managed well, could work its way into the final images. So how do you create the necessary mood, the necessary sense of calm when the stakes are so high? How do you keep your subjects as relaxed as they need to be?
There's two answers to that. The first one is that the hour that we had asked for and were more or less given wasn't then stopwatched during the actual event. We knew we could fit it in within the hour. So we didn't give ourselves time pressures during the actual shoot. The other side of it is what you mentioned there. It's really important not to let any of that pressure come into me, because it will go straight through the lens to them. But that has helped by having a long-term working relationship with them, because they sort of know that I'm going to get the job done. And I don't know, I suppose it just it goes both ways. That's the thing. It goes both ways. But the sad thing is, if you do put it under pressure, it shows instantly in the faces, in the eye, in the body position, everything. And, you know, there are, you know, tricks of the trade, a bit of laughter, a bit of banter. I personally don't particularly like the idea of being photographed myself. I find it quite an uncomfortable experience, especially if the person behind the lens spends too long analysing you through the lens. That sort of silent, very intense scrutiny, I think, is absolutely... I mean, my toes are curling while I talk to you about it. So knowing how uncomfortable it can be to be photographed, I make absolutely sure that the people that I'm photographing never have to experience that through the lens silent scrutiny. So I tend to talk quite a lot. And the other benefit of talking quite a lot is that it stops them wanting to talk because they listen. So there's less chance of you getting open mouth shots.
Yes, I'd heard that you were quite chatty during the course of your shoots.
Unfortunately, sometimes I can appear more Mr. Bean than I really want to, but it really helps relax the people on the side lens. They know the results are coming through. I've got the track record. And any sort of comedy that goes on, they don't worry about it. And it just makes them relax.
How collaborative is your process in a shoot like this?
I think collaboration is essential, because otherwise the portrait becomes purely the photographer's point of view. And with a new person that I'm photographing, I nearly always try to spend an hour with them, either in person or just chatting away, just to get a feel of who that person is and get them to hit a few balls back to me. Now, that has happened over a 20-year working relationship. We have collaborated on various ideas, which has been great. So in a way, when we start the conversation about what we may or may not do for the coronation pictures, we're already a few steps down that path, because I know roughly what they like, they know roughly what I like, or what I'm capable of, I should say. So the collaboration started many years ago, but continued right all the way through.
Now, I confess I've never had the pleasure of visiting Buckingham Palace before, but from what I've seen on the walls there, there are countless paintings. I'm sure lots of photographs too, of previous generations adorning all the walls. How do you allow that history all around you to influence your work on the shoot? Or indeed, do you? Do you try to have a clean mind and make sure that it is the work of you and whom you're working with in that moment?
It's very interesting. There's, again, two parts to answer on that. The photographs that I viewed or researched, and the paintings that I also researched. Now, the paintings on the walls of Buckingham Palace are fabulous, and I allowed myself to be influenced by one or two while we were setting up. And there's one particular painter, Winterhalter, who painted Queen Victoria quite a few times. And just looking at his angles, I definitely allowed his influence to come into some of the portraits that I did on the day of the coronation. And actually, I'm more probably talking about the angle of the throne and how much one could see of the throne. And if you look back at those paintings, you can see it adds so much to the photograph, the structure of the photograph, the composition, and the impression that it gives. But the photography side, the first coronation to be photographed was Edward VII. And it's very interesting looking at his photographs, because people were so much more familiar that their eye was educated towards paintings. Mm-hmm. So they actually painted onto the photographs so that anyone viewing them would feel a certain familiarity. And really what they painted was the ermine and the robes and stuff like that. But then, you know, technology advanced, but that's where the backdrop came in. The technology wasn't available to light a person and a room. And those rooms in the palace are enormous. And, you know, particularly in the throne room, they have red silk on the walls, and that sucks up the light. What they would do is they would paint beautiful scenes onto a canvas, be it pillars and swags and staircases, or it might be, you know, low horizons and fantastic trees. And then they'd position both the backdrop and the subject close to a studio light.
Well, this is where, is this not the, with the backdrop, Cecil Beaton and Queen Elizabeth II was, that the main photograph that I remember was her in front of a backdrop, was it not?
Yes. And I think what he was doing, because by then there was the ability to light rooms, but I think he was harking back to history and bringing forward a tradition. Which was no longer strictly necessary, but used to fantastic advantage and results. I did, I mean, not dramatically, but sort of, I did the opposite. I wanted to give the impression that sort of spring daylight was coming in through the windows. And it worked. I know it worked because someone asked me a technical question, was what was my shutter speed, which would incorporate both artificial light and daylight. So I happily told them that they'd completely fallen for my trick, which was to make it look like spring daylight coming through the window. In fact, it was a howling gale and rain was coming down left, right and center. But in the pictures, you'd think it was a nice spring day. So I basically made the reality look almost like my own personal backdrop.
What did behind the scenes look like on the day? You mentioned quite a lot of lighting that you had, a team of people helping you out as well. Were you able to maintain that sense of intimacy still on set? I'll call it on set, in the throne room. And what about all the kit? Do you find that gets in the way sometimes?
I don't know if you've ever been to NASA Space Station. I haven't. But I imagine the throne room looked a bit like that. We were there with all the satellite dishes that were, you know, enormous umbrellas and softboxes and scrims. But we had a very clear path between the positioning of the subjects in the photographs going through the lights. And it was incredibly tidy. It was a bit like walking through the Science Museum. And no, I don't think it did faze anyone. I mean, they've seen me at work before.
Yes.
So I think they might have been disappointed if I just had two umbrellas and two stands. We arrived in the morning on our bicycles, which
I saw some video of you arriving on your bicycle. It seems very low tech and very humble for the day that followed.
Yeah, but also practical, because all our equipment, including the cameras, were already in the palace set up. But it doesn't take away from the slightly unnerving feeling that you're setting off in the morning to do the biggest job of your life and you haven't even got your camera with you. You know, it doesn't feel right. It's also a practical reason, because the roads are all sealed off. So bicycle is the best way. And then there's, of course, the environmental aspect, which I just liked, tunes it very neatly with our very environmental king. But on the way back, we still only had bicycles and it was pouring with rain. And there was that moment of thinking, God, we've done this job and we've got all the cameras, well, not all the cameras, we've got some of the cameras and all the cards in these backpacks, and it's raining so hard. So we had to stop under the arch in Hyde Park Corner and just double check that the cards were still dry, because we were literally drowned rats. Anyway, they were dry and we giggled and we cycled the whole way home and laughed and had a cup of tea.
Well, thank goodness it wasn't raining that heavily in the morning on your way in. Otherwise, that would have been a different experience for the shoot itself.
That would not have been a good start.
Now, I understand that for as much control, as much preparation as you had. You were also using a different, or at least for you, a new camera system on the day for these shoots as well. What can you tell us about that?
Well, when I started my career as a portrait photographer, I was incredibly lucky to have a Hasselblad, and I loved it. I absolutely adored it. It took me a long time to actually step into the digital world for portraiture. And I want to say it's all gone well, but I started shooting with a Fujifilm GFX S100, and it did this strange thing to me. It made me fall back in love with the art of medium format portraiture. I don't know what it is about that camera. I love the results it gives. I love the feel. And I love all the technical stuff, which is way above my sort of brain capacity. But I was incredibly lucky to have been introduced to that camera. And knowing that these portraits had to be done in medium format, or not knowing, but that was my choice, I was really, really happy to have found Fujifilm. And again, I'm not 100% well-versed on the environmental credentials of Fujifilm, but as I understand it, as in the research that I personally have done, they are the most environmentally friendly camera production company that I can find. So many aspects of this camera I just think are fantastic. And a funny thing also, I didn't realize to start off with, but it's such a badge of honor to have a Fujifilm camera. The people that come up to me and nudge me and tell me about theirs or whatever, it's like a new club that I didn't know I was joining.
Well, I'm very pleased that you've found a camera that you're able to connect with and indeed build a connection with those who you're taking portraits of. The environmental story you talk about there fits in very well with King Charles's environmental principles and viewpoints as well. So it sounds like a very happy match indeed.
Yeah.
Hugo, it's been terrific to chat with you. Thank you so much for taking time to join us.
Well, thank you. And thanks for letting me run away with some of my thoughts. Thank you.
Well, there we go. You know what? I really enjoyed chatting with Hugo. As part of my research, I'd read a few interviews he'd done in the past. And, you know, of course, his work over the last, well, couple of decades or so, really, really well documented. But I struggled to find any of him on camera or on audio at all. All I really knew was an interview someone managed to grab with him on his bicycle outside of Buckingham Palace on the afternoon, I guess, of the coronation. It is that meticulous attention to detail. I'm pleased we were able to go into some of that in the interview that we did. What did you make of Hugo?
I thought he was fantastic. Obviously, he's one of those chaps. He's like the old rock and roll photographers from the tabloids from years past. They're full of stories. They've got great anecdotes. And you know, a one of a kind, as you say, he's sort of the quintessential royal photographer, and the quintessential royal photographer in the sense that he's very much behind the scenes. There's little chatter involving him and what he thinks about things. So for you to be able to sort of pin him down and get him to sort of spill the beans a little bit on his process and on the how he got into the day. What I found most fascinating about that is his talk about the process of the day itself. If I can make this all about me for a second, so I was fortunate enough to, when I was working as an assistant, my old boss was commissioned to do two prime minister's portraits. So he's got two photographs hanging in number 10. And I thought, oh, well, that's nice. They must have made a full day of that and you had lots of time. And he said, no, he had 20 minutes. And 10 minutes of that was finding his way into the labyrinthine part of Downing Street. They were doing the photographing. So I got in there. By the time it was time to shoot, he probably had 5 minutes. And it was kind of like the subject comes in. Sits where you tell him to sit or stands where you tell him to stand, you get your shots and then he goes. And I found that the most fascinating bit of my boss's anecdote, to hear how it was in the royal context. And you think, wow, the pressure that professional photographers, this is what everyone always says, oh, what, you know, why do photographers cost so much? Because they have to get it right under extremely compressed time and pressure situations. You know, that he's got his team of assistants who helped him out no end. But at the end of the day, if something went wrong with those images, he's the guy whose name is on them. He's the guy who pushed the shutter. And, you know, his reputation is on the line with those images.
Thank you, James. And thank you to Hugo as well. And I'm sure you've seen them already, but if you haven't, we'll try to find some links to put in the show notes to those images that Hugo took. Now, James, you put out a question a few days ago about who the heck gives a damn about cameras that only shoot in black and white. Well, it turns out that a lot of people give a damn, some very strong dams they give.
Well, the dear and darling readers of digitalcameraworld.com, or at least one or two of them have. And a lot of them had some fun with it and sort of took the conversation in sort of the spirit it was. And I was being a little bit cheeky with my comments. But I think ultimately, for those who don't know, so of course, most of us are familiar with the world of digital cameras and mirrorless cameras and cameras that can shoot 8K and cameras that can shoot 100 megapixels. But a lot of people aren't aware that there are some cameras, some very expensive cameras at that, that only shoot in black and white. So not an Instagram filter, not anything done in post-production, nothing in After Effects. It's a camera that physically only shoots black and white. And there's different ends of the spectrum on this. So the reason this came up as a talking point was within the last month, we've had two of these cameras. So Leica releases a monochrome, no E, because it's Leica. They release a monochrome edition of a lot of their cameras. So most recently, it was the Leica M11 monochrome, which is about £9,000 worth of camera. So you pay £9,000 for a camera that only shoots black and white. A couple of weeks later, or around the same time, Pentax released Pentax K3 Mark III DSLR, a little bit cheaper at about £2,200, but again, only shoots in black and white. Now, if you want to get really silly, if you want to get really serious about this, Red makes camera. There's a Red Epic camera that only shoots black and white. There is a Phase 1 IQ 140 that's, you know, thick end of £60,000, only shoots black and white. I don't dispute that there is some necessity, especially as someone who works with image quality and image fidelity. I understand that you want the best tools for the job. What I don't necessarily, certainly for my work, and my work is not a lot of professionals' work, but can I get satisfactory enough results with my existing cameras shooting in a monochrome mode? For my work, yes, I can. Now, I shoot probably 60, 70% of my stuff in black and white. When I do so...
Oh, really?
I do, yeah. So I don't do what a lot of folks do, which is, again, I'm not criticizing. This is not any sort of damnation. When I shoot in black and white, I turn my camera into black and white mode. I turn it into monochrome because that's just how my brain works. Okay. I don't convert color to black and white retroactively. I do if I need to rescue a picture that doesn't quite work in color and I want to use it. Like if there's a model's expression that is perfect, but for whatever reason, you know, there's too much green in the background or something, I might do a conversion then. But typically, if I'm shooting black and white, I will shoot with black and white mode in my camera. So I understand the principle of it.
And that's because you tend to shoot portraits, is it? The portrait form that you find best fits black and white for your work?
For my work, it's two things mainly. Portraiture, a lot of times, my ex-wife was a redhead, and it seems criminal as a lover of red hair to shoot red hair in black and white. But there is so much tonality. And this is the thing, when photographs or images in general are removed of the distraction of color, they are then focused on shape, texture, form, dimension, all these other wonderful aspects of photography that are otherwise obscured by, you know, oh, wow, look at all the color rendition, or oh, that's look at the blue pop in the subject's eyes or whatever. So it's great for portraiture. It's also great for street photography and reportage and behind the scenes. You know, I alluded to my previous life as a photography assistant. I used to do a lot of behind the scenes work for photo shoots. And there's something about that gritty, tri-X-y kind of old school black and white look that just works. So the point being, I understand the value of black and white and of having really good quality black and white. What I don't quite necessarily vibe with is spending £9,000 to only be able to shoot that, because you can't convert a black and white into color. Mm. Well, okay, well, maybe you can with AI. Maybe that's a conversation for another point. But my color camera can shoot black and white very capably. And for my work, that's fine. Do I want to limit myself by spending either £2,500 or £9,000 on a camera that cannot shoot color? Personally, no, I don't think that's worth it. Now, the punters, my dear readers, took exception to this for good technical reasons.
Yes. Now, I saw conversation around a Bayer filter, for example, and how when you're not shooting through a Bayer filter, you get More information.
Absolutely, and it's a similar principle, different process to anti-aliasing filters and things that sort of prevent moiré, another pasting happening. So you stick a filter on, it stops the moiré, but it also reduces the sharpness. So you kind of you pick your poison at a certain point. So yes, by using a specific technology to shoot a specific result, you are going to get improved fidelity, improved quality. And I don't dispute that. I don't disagree with that. Yes, for that purpose, if you're an archivist, if you are somebody who works in a museum, or you are recording material for generations to come, we know that Hugo, for example, used a very specific tool. He used the GFX 100S to photograph the king because he wanted to shoot in medium format to sort of archive quality, as much fidelity as possible, so that image can withstand the test of time. So when we're watching 12K TVs and 20K TVs, this image is going to hold up for generations to come. So I understand the principle of investing in the tech. But my open question was to me, to you, to anyone else, is who buys these cameras? And it turns out quite a lot of people do. And the readership certainly put me in my place when it came to questioning the validity of these devices.
Well, if you didn't read James's article, then there's a link to it in the show notes. And if you shoot in black and white and agree, or you don't and you disagree with James, then let us know. thephotographyshow@futurenet.com. That's thephotographyshow@futurenet.com, or hit us up on social media. Right, it's the time of the show where we pick our gadget of the month. Each month we share a knickknack that's caught our eye and who knows, could be your next essential accessory. It doesn't have to be photography related, but it probably should be given the name of the podcast. James, what have you got for us?
So this is a rather delightful bit of kit with a rather baffling bit of marketing video around it. I know you enjoyed, David, so... it is, would you believe, it is the summer of birds. At least it is the summer of birds, according to Bird Buddy. So Bird Buddy is sort of a Kickstarter company, a Kickstarter product. They started this particular product, right? It's brilliant. It's a bird feeder or a bird bath with a trail camera built in, basically. So that one of them is a hummingbird feeder. Oh, gosh, what I wouldn't give to have hummingbirds in my garden, David. I don't, sadly. But essentially, so we're looking at a bird bath camera, so you can get those shots of birds coming into your garden, having a good old splash around. Now, these are the sort of things that they sold like gangbusters over the lockdown period when, we were all locked in our houses with nothing else to do but find entertainment where we could find it. So these things were absolutely fantastic. I think most people who want a trail camera or want that sort of thing probably already got one. But what made this stick out to me was the absolutely bizarre marketing video. I don't know if you can put it into words, David, but it was striking. I don't know how much you told me about the product itself, but it was something to behold.
It really, really was. It's almost like a Eurovision Song Contest for Kickstarter videos. It's got a lot of the vibe, and you've got this guy who is in this strange ethereal landscape who is doing rollerblading around and all sorts of gesticulations. And as I understand it, it has obliterated its Kickstarter goal. And there will be many, many of these making their way over to viewers. I mean, what I would have to say is that I don't know about the image quality. Stepping back from the kind of images that we've been talking about with high-end cameras on the show so far today, the 5-megapixel camera that this Bird Buddy affords is a step down, perhaps. But I guess it's all about the timing and the access rather than the beautiful quality image that you might get had you got a long lens and a lot of time to lie down and try and capture one of these more manually.
Absolutely. And this really was the main thrust of the Bird Buddy project, because it's an AI driven, or at least it is advertised as such, being an AI powered device. And that first and foremost is not to get clever photographs, it's to identify the birds that visit your garden. So were you lucky enough to live somewhere where the hummingbirds come into your garden, it could tell you exactly what kind, but it takes a photograph. Yes. And it's more like it's a bit like a visual dictionary for bird watchers. So it takes the photograph, uses that to say, oh, this is a red-nosed whatever it is that's come to visit you today, and tells you how rare it is and that sort of thing. So that provides tremendous value. But as you say, David, I'm not sure that the image quality, again, disclaimers, haven't seen finished product, anything like that, but a 5-megapixel camera is going to be quite limited in its scope. Certainly with nothing other than ambient lighting outside in your backyard, going to be quite limited in scope. And it was interesting that the video didn't really depict any of the results you might expect from this camera. Yeah. That was the first thing my partner noticed. She sort of said, it looks interesting, but what are the pictures like? And I said, I guess you've got to use your imagination. But yeah, the AI bit is the most interesting bit for me. And if you get a pretty picture of a pretty bird in the process, then, you know, I guess that's cherry on the parfait.
So my gadget of the month is the Autex Phone Pro Dome Kit. Now this is for your smartphone, and it's a case with this enormous dome about the size of a bowl of jelly or something that goes over the camera, the business end of your smartphone. But it enables you to take underwater images in a safe manner. Now, I'm not going to lie, I have in the past taken a supposedly waterproof smartphone into the sea and got some magical pictures that 15 minutes later I was not able to get off of said phone because whatever waterproofness had either gone from my phone or the salt water had melted whatever gaskets were in place to keep it waterproof. But something like this would certainly help there. Now, I've worked with somebody in the past. He's a photographer called Rob Layton, actually based over in Australia, but he comes over to Europe, and I've hosted some panels and things at photography and smartphone events in the past. He is an incredible photographer and content creator, specializing very, very much in what you would say is high-end smartphone creativity, really cramming every last bit of know-how to turn your common or garden smartphone into something that you can create professional images on. And being living in Australia, living near the coast, he uses domes like these to get the most incredible surfing imagery. And, you know, he gets those images where you are, and video, I should say, as well, where you're half in the water, half out of the water. He's following surfers around. And it's incredible. It is a different world under the water. And being able to take your phone under there to get some of these images, particularly with the kind of lens effect. It's like a kind of fisheye lens, which is maybe appropriate for being an underwater camera. I think it's incredible. They aren't super cheap, but if you are going, maybe you've got a great holiday lined up and you're going to some Greek islands or something where the water is wonderfully clear and you're wanting a way without investing a ton of money in a big camera case to take a big more expensive camera underwater, that's a serious undertaking, then grabbing one of these domes I think is probably a really neat way of getting some great quality images and making them really, really accessible. You are still looking at between $150 and $350, I think, depending on whether you go with a flat one or the big dome version of it. But that might be a lot cheaper than taking out an enormous big dedicated camera housing, which I know can run into some serious money as well. So yeah, that is the Autex Phone Pro Dome Kit. Have you ever done any underwater photography?
I have. And funny you mentioned Greek islands, because I did some, to call it underwater photography is probably a bit grandiose, but I did take some underwater photos while I was in Greece last year, around this time last year, actually. It's an interesting proposition, isn't it? Because yes, this bit of kit is a couple of $100. But the flip side, what you just alluded to, is it's a lot more than a couple $100 to replace your phone if it gives up the ghost in pursuit of underwater photographs.
Yeah.
It's also a couple $100 compared to the price of a tough camera or the price of, you know, a quote-unquote big boy camera with a housing. I love using my phone underwater, but it terrifies me. Because for the reasons you've just said, you know, there's such a big part of me that no matter what the IPX rating is, no matter how many people on trusted reviews have said that it's this or that, I know it's going to be mine that goes wrong. It's going to be mine because it always is. So do I want to take that risk with all my stuff that's backed or not backed up on my phone? Or do I want to spend a bit of money? And yes, maybe money I could have spent on, you know, beer vouchers or something else, but it's going to keep my camera safe. And the other thing is, with underwater photography, using a proper, again, quote-unquote, proper camera underwater is very tricky because you're having to adjust aperture, shutter speed, ISO, and the lighting is so challenging. You need a very capable camera to do so. your phone is one of the most capable all-purpose cameras, best for taking pictures at concerts, you know, where the lighting is awful, pictures at night where the lighting's awful, taking pictures underwater. Your phone just knows what to do. And all you've kind of got to do is just sort of aim it, point in the bit you want to be exposed correctly, press the shutter button. It's a great hack for underwater photography using your phone, but with that proviso. Make sure you've got some protection for it.
Yeah, it's a small price to pay for peace of mind. Anyway, that is about all for this month. Join us next time for, well, more of the same, I hope, because it's been great fun this time around. Remember, new episodes of the show will drop on the first Thursday of every month, and we would just love it if you could subscribe, leave a review, tell your friends, tell your camera clubs, whatever, because, look, we're a new podcast. Every little helps, and we'd love to hear from you and maybe even build a bit of a community around the show. So do share your thoughts on social media or drop us an email at thephotographyshow@futurenet.com, on Instagram at thephotographyshow, and on Twitter at UK Photo Show. And I'm not sure if I'm supposed to say this yet, James, but we are looking to do a live recording of this podcast at the actual photography show, the in-person event at the NEC, the National Exhibition Centre in Birmingham, England, where it takes place next in March 2024, from the 16th to the 19th of March. Now, if you've not heard of the photography show, or if you've not been, then, well, it takes place across 4 days. We've got tens of thousands of photography professionals and enthusiasts from all around the world who join us for a veritable festival of photography and filmmaking and video too, I should add. The big brands and manufacturers are there, and it's a great opportunity, a really good opportunity to get hands-on with some of the latest imaging kit. One of those rare opportunities you get when everyone is all under one roof, all of the big manufacturers, all the big brands. It's the best place, really, just to experiment, to learn, to try out, and even to make purchases there as well. There's often some great show deals. Not only that, but we have, frankly, some of the world's greatest image makers there too. And in recent years, we've had everyone from Rankin to Bailey, Sebastio Salgado, who was incredible to interview, Martin Parr as well, on the super stage. You know, we've been talking on the show today about photographing royals with Hugo earlier on. Well, it's photography royalty who we hear from at the in-person event too. I'm not sure we've had any actual royalty visit the show yet, maybe in 2024. Who knows? Anyway, you can find out more about the show at photographyshow.com. James, it's been terrific chatting with you. Thank you so much for joining us. Where can people find out more about what you get up to in the meantime?
The best place for anyone to come to, if you're not terribly bored by me and my outlandish opinions so far, come along to digitalcameraworld.com. It's a great repository for reviews, for news, for rumors. My specialty is the scuttlebutt that's going on in the industry. You can hear my inflammatory opinions on things like why people might or might not buy black and white cameras. So yes, I would ask people to come along to digitalcameraworld.com and just join the conversation. Send me an email. Let me know what you think about the madness I've just been speaking about.
Super stuff. Listen, James, thanks again for joining us, and thank you all for joining us. See you next time. Bye-bye for now.